This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Granite State Democratic delegates joined their counterparts from around the country at a packed convention center last night in Philadelphia when Hillary Clinton accepted the Democratic nomination for president.
When any barrier falls in America, it clears the way for everyone.
Now that both party conventions are over, expect state races to heat up. Already this week, Republican candidates for governor held a debate hosted by radio station WGIR. Manchester mayor and former state senator Ted Gatzis touted his private sector credentials as he runs for governor.
I understand what it is to create jobs. I understand that we need to lower electric rates, we need to lower insurance rates, and we must make sure we get regulations off of small businessmen's backs.
Another Republican in the race, former State Senator Jeanne Forrester, weighed in on a longstanding Granite State debate, expanded gambling. Forrester said it's not necessary because New Hampshire doesn't have a revenue problem, it has a spending problem.
When we search for revenues such as gambling or casino gambling or whatever you're talking about, it's not the right way to go. It's going to hurt small businesses. We don't need it in the state of New Hampshire, and I would not support it.
And all the candidates touched on another key issue, substance abuse, given that last year more than 400 Granite Staters died from overdose. But a new treatment center did open this week called Farnham North in Franklin. Vice President Cheryl Wilkie says the lack of treatment beds has been heartbreaking for her and the families she serves.
We know what the need is, and we can't help as many people as we want, and we understand they're angry at us because they think it's us that doesn't want to put their child in a bed.
Today in The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and let's hear from you as we catch up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website, NH Political Capital. And Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Kevin Landergan, senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Kevin, really nice to see you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
And joining us from Philadelphia, where she's been covering the Democratic National Convention, is Ella Nilsson. She's a reporter with the Concord Monitor. And Ella, thank you for taking time out.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, and Ella, let's start with you. Mood and reaction, please, among New Hampshire delegates toward Hillary Clinton's big speech last night.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wrote about this in my article in today's Monitor. There was a lot of emotion from both Clinton and Sanders delegates, sort of for different reasons. Yesterday, I was interviewing a bunch of Clinton delegates, and people were already very emotional. Some people who have known Secretary Clinton for a long time in New Hampshire, who campaigned with her husband back in 1992 and have known her since then, were already crying in the hotel lobby in the morning, just thinking about what it was going to be like when she accepted the presidential nomination as the first ever female nominee. On the other hand, Sanders supporters have, it's also been an emotional week for them, sort of for a different reason. Some of them said they sort of feel now resigned to this. I mean, some are certainly very also excited that it is a female nominee this time, but ultimately it's not the candidate that they wanted to see. And a lot of supporters, Sanders supporters that I talked to said that, you know, they are coming around to supporting Secretary Clinton, but it's going to take some time and for them to kind of process their own emotions about Sanders ultimately not prevailing.
Well, and again, I want to hear from our listeners, especially if you are a Hillary Clinton supporter or were a Bernie Sanders supporter during the primary, your reactions to Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech last night, too, are welcome during our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. NewHampshireDelegation.org. Ella, another question for you. How awkward was it this week to have the New Hampshire delegation split this way, really almost 50-50?
Yeah, well, they were split. They were split exactly 50-50. 16 votes went to Sanders and 16 votes went to Clinton, despite the fact that Sanders overwhelmingly won the state during the New Hampshire primary. And the balance was tipped by the state superdelegates, who all except for Senator Martha Fuller Clark supported Hillary Clinton. And it was a process for the kind of that ultimately that split vote. I mean, typically New Hampshire votes unanimously for a candidate during roll call at conventions. I understand the last time they had a split vote was in 1992, so it's been a long time. And this is definitely something that was talked about in the first couple of days. You know, Sanders delegates went in not really sure what was going to happen. A lot of them said they were going to support their candidate all the way through. And there were some sort of negotiations and talks, and they all sort of had to get in and talk amongst themselves about what they were going to do. Ultimately, they decided and agreed with New Hampshire Democratic Party leadership that they were going to, while they were going to vote for Senator Sanders and split the delegation's vote, they did make an announcement on Tuesday morning to the New Hampshire press that were there that ultimately they were going to all individually support Secretary Clinton in November and, I guess, sort of decide amongst themselves individually, you know, how much their support was going to mean, whether that was going to mean campaigning for her, volunteering for her, or just voting for her in the election.
Well, and Kevin Landrigan, you've been covering New Hampshire politics for a long, long time, and I'd love your thoughts, too, on what Ella describes for us, this sort of unusual split among our Granite State delegation there at the Democratic National Convention, and then this coming together.
Yeah, this really is unusual, to be sure. This is my 10th presidential primary process going through it all. I've never seen a convention like this. There's never been a convention in the last 10 where you had the president, the vice president, the vice presidential running mate speaking on the same night for a candidate. That's extremely significant and obviously extremely helpful to Hillary Clinton. She's been around for so long. This doesn't seem like a new big story, but it is a new big story. I mean, the first female nominated in history. And among Clinton folks, I sense, and I don't know if Ella feels this way, but I sense among Clinton folks a real confidence that this is a winning campaign. This is going to work. This is going to happen. Donald Trump is going to implode in the fall. I don't necessarily prescribe to that, but the Clinton folks clearly do. And they acted that way throughout this convention. They certainly acted that way with the pick of Tim Kaine as the running mate. This is not a risky pick. This is a governing pick. This is someone who you think can really do the job if she became debilitated, if you will. So this campaign and this candidate are feeling very confident. You saw her baiting, taunting Trump last night during the speech. Like I said, that's a confident candidate.
Well, what did the Clinton folks at the convention, Kevin, offer the Bernie folks, given the huge margin that Bernie Sanders won here back in February?
Well, certainly, and Ella can speak to this better than I, she's out there in Philadelphia, the Sanders came to the delegates in their breakfast Wednesday morning and essentially said, look, we struck a great deal here. We got the most progressive platform in the Democratic Party in its history. And I think Sanders, obviously, I talked to a number of Sanders delegates out there in the last couple of days, and he was made clear to them, look, the revolution doesn't stop now. I'm trying to figure out a way to keep this thing going, to create an organization that can not only follow these issues, but frankly, also hold Hillary Clinton accountable during the campaign and if she's elected after in terms of governing, that she follows through on a lot of these promises on whether it's pay equality, the minimum wage, trade deals, all of those things, environmental regulation, all of those issues. The Sanders folks and the delegates were very outspoken to me that they're going to keep watching Hillary Clinton and make sure she toes the line.
What do you think, Dean, along with what Kevin said, what did the Bernie Sanders folks gain from the National Democratic Party as well as their own state leaders at this convention? Again, given that Bernie Sanders won by a 22% margin here in New Hampshire, it was huge.
Right. Well, you know, if you listen to Hillary Clinton's speech last night, the Sanders campaign got a good chunk of Bernie Sanders' economic agenda. A lot of the domestic policy in that speech last night was right out of the progressive playbook. So that had to make the Sanders folks happy. But the Clinton campaign's in a difficult position. They needed to keep the Sanders supporters happy. They made sure that all the votes were recorded rather than simply doing it by acclamation. They waited until the very end of the roll call in Vermont and let Vermont go last, and then Bernie Sanders moved by acclamation. But first, each delegation got to cast votes for Sanders. There was a little bit of conflict in the Republican convention because some Cruz delegates felt that their votes were not counted properly due to some of the rules of the RNC. So they were sort of handled them very carefully. I think Sanders did everything he was required to do in terms of endorsing Hillary Clinton, asking his supporters to go along. A lot of them will. Some of them won't, particularly on military and foreign policy. I think for a lot of Sanders voters, she's just too hawkish. And in fact, you heard some heckling during some of the retired military speakers.
There were signs in the audience. Yeah, no more wars.
Right. But yeah, they're getting. I mean, the impact. I mean, the Hillary Clinton that I knew in the 90s. And the whole Clinton, the Democratic Leadership Council, a sort of centrist group with Clinton and Joe Lieberman and Evan Bayh and a number of other people. This is a very different Hillary Clinton. She's been tremendously impacted by Bernie Sanders' economic agenda. I think the campaign takes heart in some of the data out there that says 85 to 90% of Sanders people will vote for her, but she's not going to get all of them. Some of those folks have already said they'll vote for, most likely, Jill Stein of the Green Party.
Well, and next week we're going to take a look at third parties. So I'll set that aside for now, Dean, but it's a good point. The exchange number for you to join us on our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's an email that came in from Ian in Manchester. And Ella, I'll throw this one to you. Could you speak about what the email leaks mean for the future of the DNC? Besides the resignation of Wasserman Schultz, what will happen? This is a large point of contention for Bernie supporters because this was largely ignored at the convention. Ella, what about that last point that Ian makes, that the email leaks concerning the Democratic National Committee trying to put down Bernie Sanders' campaign was a point of contention for Sanders supporters, especially at the beginning of the week?
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of wanted to address that sort of going off of, the concessions that Clinton's campaign made to Sanders and the sort of show of unity. I think the emails was sort of the biggest thing that rocked that, because it was, you know, this revelation right at the beginning of this week that's supposed to be about unity and Democrats coming together, that, you know, that there is actually evidence that the DNC was favoring Clinton during the primaries. You know, whether her campaign knew about that I don't think anybody is sort of saying that, but certainly DNC officials, there was some bias there. And I think, you know, there was definitely anger from Sanders supporters, but more than that, what was interesting to me was for Sanders supporters that were coming around and saying, you know, I am willing to support Clinton, there was a real concern that her campaign had hired Debbie Wasserman Schultz for a volunteer. I want to be clear, it's a volunteer, not a paid position as an honorary chair in the campaign. So her national press secretary, Brian Fallon, stopped by the New Hampshire delegation breakfast on Wednesday morning. And he was pressed pretty hard on this question from Sanders delegates, who said, you know, I'm supporting Clinton in November. That's not a question. But why are you guys doing this? Why are you hiring Debbie Wasserman Schultz? Because this is just adding sort of more fuel to the Republicans and Trump, and this is baggage that you're just going to have to carry around. And we basically don't want to have to be defending that if we're going to come around to Clinton and support her. So I think that was a very sort of interesting contrast and an interesting question going forward that I think is not going to go away very easily.
So Ella, the national campaign chair for the Hillary Clinton campaign stopped by the New Hampshire breakfast. Is that what you said?
National her national press
her national press person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I do wonder, though, how much attention New Hampshire, given our status as a swing state, might expect to get Ella from the Clinton campaign, visits from her, visits from vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine, visits from Senator Sanders himself. What have you heard toward that end?
Right. So Tim Kaine is supposed to be stopping by the state in a couple of weeks. Right now, it's unclear if that is going to be a private fundraiser or if it's going to be a public event. I've heard more of the fundraiser. But one of the things that I wrote about this week is that members of Clinton's kind of higher up campaign staff have interesting ties to New Hampshire. You know, her campaign manager, Robbie Mook, was actually born at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital and went to Hanover High School, although he technically grew up and lived over the border in Sharon, Vermont. But he has some deep ties to New Hampshire. He ran U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen's 2008 bid, which was successful, and you know, he has a lot of ties both to New Hampshire and Vermont. Brian Fallon, her national press secretary, actually used to work for the Manchester City Dems right out of college.
Wow!
And they
you can't escape it, can you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so New Hampshire politics is something that's always been very important to the Clinton campaign. And they talked to me pretty candidly about how when she was losing badly before the primary this year, there was still a lot of emphasis on her making appearances in New Hampshire before the primary, because they knew that they wanted to keep good ties in New Hampshire for the general election. And so I think that we're definitely going to see a lot of Clinton campaign stops in the future and you know, people stopping by the state. New Hampshire is definitely a big priority for them.
Well, Ella, thank you so much for being with us. I hope you have easy and safe travels back to the Granite State. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Ella Nilsson, Concord Monitor reporter. Again, she reported from Philadelphia this week at the Democratic National Convention. Dean, what do you think? How much will we see Hillary Clinton, Tim Kaine, Bernie Sanders, and other high-profile surrogates? Maybe President Obama, yeah. Maybe Michelle Obama?
Oh, I think we'll certainly be in the mix. You know, you always get a feeling sometime in the fall, usually we're in September, getting on into October, whether or not you know, New Hampshire is going to be a pivotal swing state. There have been some elections in previous years, 2000 comes to mind, where those four electoral votes would have made a big difference. And, you know, New Hampshire has this long political tradition. It plays well as a place for grassroots politicking. You're reaching a regional audience where Hillary Clinton will be quite strong. So I think we'll certainly see the Democrats here. You know, Trump may stop by occasionally as well. They're saying they're going to compete strongly in the swing states, although New Hampshire, I think, wasn't on their initial list. But I think we may see him as well.
So, Kevin, what have you heard from various campaigns? We've been talking about Democrats because this was their week. But what about Democrats or Republicans? Have you heard about any high-profile visits from, you know, the Obamas and Trumps and Clintons of the world?
Yeah, I think certainly the Trump, as Dean said, initially New Hampshire wasn't on the Republican map as strong. And one of the reasons is, you know, while this is a swing state, a purple state, it's gone Democratic since 2000. But for Ralph Nader, you know, it could have been President Al Gore and Al Gore winning New Hampshire in 2000. But Trump has developed a real affinity for New Hampshire. We've seen it already. He's been here twice already since he kind of wrapped up the nomination. His people point out it's a little over an hour flight from Trump Tower in New York. He's coming and he's going to come often. And demographically, as we've seen since 2000, a number of states are more Democratic than they were back then. I mean, states like – so it's very possible, and I've seen the maps electorally, that Hillary Clinton can win the presidency without winning New Hampshire, without winning Ohio. And why is that? Because states like Wisconsin, New Mexico, a number of these states that were always in play demographically have changed. Greater minority populations, more urban than they used to be, and much more Democratic leaning.
You know, as the conventions wrap up now, and interesting this week, Kevin, back-to-back conventions.
Yeah.
So
and early, too, which is very unusual, too. Usually we're not – we're not even into August yet, and it's over.
Well, and people need to sort of clean the TV room so they can watch the Olympics, but we'll set that aside for now. So the nominees are official. The conventions are over. What do you think, both of you? I'll turn to you first, Kevin. How will we see these presidential campaigns affecting our state races here in the Granite State?
Yeah, I think they'll affect them quite a bit. They always seem to. And we've got the marquee U.S. Senate race between Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan, and both interestingly enough, we see both candidates trying to put the other on the defensive about the candidate.
The nominee.
Know? Exactly.
Given the high unfavorability ratings for both of these folks.
For both of these folks. And particularly for Ayotte, Trump is a real problem among women. Running against Maggie Hassan, Kelly Ayotte needs to do well among women in order to win re-election. And right now, Donald Trump is toxic.
Well, an ad released just this week by friends of Kelly Ayotte took aim at Ayotte's Democratic rival, Governor Hassan, by claiming that the governor, just like nominee Hillary Clinton, plays by a different set of rules. Let's hear just a little bit from that ad.
And now Maggie Hassan is skipping out on the job we elected her to do so she can rub elbows and raise money out of state, just like Hillary Clinton. Maggie Hassan wants to play by a different set of rules than the rest of us.
What do you think, Dean? That's certainly been a line that Republicans have used against Hillary Clinton. Will it work against Governor Hassan?
I don't know. I mean, this issue of you know, going out of state to raise funds, it's just the reality of the way the process works now, given Citizens United. It's funny. I remember back in 2004 when Howard Dean was the governor of Vermont and decided to run for president. Same sort of thing over in Vermont, where his opponents wanted his schedule. They wanted to know, you know, who was paying for his travel, where he was going, all those kinds of issues. So this is a very common political strategy. You know, the big difference for me between the two parties is the candidates for statewide office on the Democratic side have generally embraced Hillary Clinton, Maggie Hassan quite strongly, certainly. And on the Republican side, you know, the Senate race, clearly Kelly Ayotte is in a difficult position. Some of the House candidates have been more supportive of Donald Trump. But I just think if Maggie Hassan doesn't have to deal with the issue of trying to distance herself from Hillary Clinton, because every time we've talked to her about Hillary Clinton, she's been a very strong supporter. So I think that's the biggest fundamental difference. There's sort of less ambiguity in terms of how the top of the ticket relates to the other statewide office seekers.
Let's take a call, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And in Manchester, Kevin's calling in. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hello. I was hoping I could get your panel to comment on the recent hiring of Debbie Wasserman Schultz by the Hillary campaign. I know you just addressed this, but in particular, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard that Tim Kaine, her current VP pick, used to be the DNC chair back in the 08 election, and Schultz was a co-chair or chair of Hillary's national campaign, and Tim Kaine stepped down and recommended Schultz as his replacement. Then, lo and behold, Schultz ends up helping out probably unproportionately Hillary in the whole primary process. And once she gets booted out for this impropriety, she gets immediately picked up by the Clinton campaign again. And lo and behold, Tim Kaine also gets rewarded for his being a benefactor of Clinton by being her VP pick. So the entire situation there seems a little more in-depth and shady than just Schultz, you know, just the Schultz
and
hiring.
Kevin, I got to let you go, but you seem to be echoing the sentiments of our earlier emailer who isn't so happy about this promotion of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Thanks for being with us. More of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the top Granite State headlines of the week, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the roundup this week are Kevin Landrigan, senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And with us now for a few minutes is Brian Walston, NHPR's digital journalist. He's been reporting on money and politics with NHPR's election team. And Brian, we really appreciate you taking a couple minutes. Thank you.
Morning, Laura.
Well, you've reported that the U.S. Senate race between Maggie Hassan and Kelly Ayotte is on its way to being the most expensive in New Hampshire political history. Let's break this down, Brian, if we could, please. Just give us the numbers first.
Well, all told right now, it's $34 to $35 million. And most of that is from independent political groups. I mean, these are PACs and super PACs and nonprofits that aren't affiliated with the two campaigns. So they've accounted for $3 out of every $4 that has been spent so far.
$3 out of every $4 comes from people not even affiliated with either of these two campaigns.
Right. I mean, these are interest groups in a way. I mean, they're supposed to be independent of the candidates themselves. The ads you might see sort of more or less try to touch on issues. The big spender is a group called One Nation, and they have tried to really sort of leverage the opioid epidemic in a way. They've ran a trio of ads in June and July that were specifically addressed at that issue, which is big in New Hampshire, of course. They're involved in several Senate races around the country, and their focus is really on Senate races, trying to elect Republicans.
That's interesting. Yeah. What's the name of the group again, Brian?
It's called One Nation PAC. It's a part of the portfolio of Karl Rove Groups, Crossroads and Crossroads GPS. Are two groups that are part of that. And this group spun off of another organization a few years ago.
So $35 million at this point.
Right.
Here we are at the end of July. We still have several months left.
Sure.
So that's why you feel confident, Brian, saying this race is on target to being the most expensive.
Well, if you
New
look,
history.
Shaheen and Brown was the biggest.
That was 2 years ago.
Yeah, in 2014. And that was about $54 million altogether. So we're well on our way to that point right now. And, you know, if you look at it, Ayotte and Hassan have really accounted for a very small number so far, but I expect that's going to really change.
Kevin, I can tell you want to jump in. What are your thoughts here on these totals that Brian's giving us?
Yeah, there's a good story by Brian, really good story, and really speaks to today's campaign finance laws and the fact that there are loopholes bigger than you can drive Mack trucks through. A lot of these shady groups, these special interest groups, don't have to disclose their donors. So we really we have to do investigation to tell who's supporting them, and at least we know where they spend their money when they spend it on the TV station. But my favorite thing about this phenomenon is the names, because the names are never about transparency, and they're always about good government, meaning sounding good government. Americans for Responsible Solutions.
Wow. Is who could be against that?
Yeah, and
that
is, is that a conservative group or a liberal group? I don't know. Clear Path Action. That's another one. Ending Spending Action Fund. I think both parties say they want to get rid of wasteful spending. That happens to be a conservative super PAC.
Is there one called Mom, Kids, and Apple Pie?
Exactly. There has been an Apple Pie PAC before in past elections. And that was a state legislator from New Hampshire, no longer with us, who was making so much fun of these names that he came up with the Motherhood and Apple Pie PAC.
Well, and Brian, here's another question. What are these groups spending the money on? I mean, lots of TV for sure. I got a lot of glossy mailers in 2014 that I thought about putting in the fireplace, but I wasn't sure if I should.
Well, I mean,
that's another story. But what are they going to spend the money on?
The lion's share of this is television, digital ads, some print ads, mailers, of course. But, you know, so far, I mean, my calculation, this is the back of the envelope, it's still about 22 out of 24, 25 million has been on television and digital ads.
What about grassroots, Brian? I remember in the last election, we heard about a shift. Some of these groups, not sure whether all the money they spent in 2012 really, quote unquote, paid off, the ones that supported Mitt Romney. So in 2014, I remember hearing about some of these groups acting more like traditional parties, going door to door, shaking hands, doing shoe leather.
Well, it's hard to say. I don't expect a lot of that's happening right now. I mean,
still early.
You know, there's a couple million dollars spent on so-called direct voter contact. Now, you know, that's the way they describe it in their filing with the FEC, but you don't know. My guess is it's mostly mailers and some phone calls. It's, okay. I don't know that they're getting out there to do. One thing, is, you know, what's interesting, and Kevin and Dean will remember this, is this Shaheen and Brown were had this pledge over them. 2 years ago, and the same thing happened this year. Kelly Ayotte said, I would like my opponent to sign this pledge to limit outside spending. And like Brown, Hassan tried to, you know, change the terms a little bit, and of course it all blew away, and we see what's happening as a result.
Dean, what do you make of all this?
It's amazing to me how much the spending environment has changed in the last 15 to 20 years. I think it's Brian's piece that mentions that the Ayotte-Hodes race in 2010 was like $15 million total, and I remember going back to the mid-90s, even less than that. You know, I've been more skeptical than a lot of people that all of this money really makes that much of a difference. A lot of these outside ads, I think they're just sort of poorly constructed. They kind of miss the mark. They're done by outside groups that don't really have a feel for the kind of the nuance of New Hampshire politics. And they just sort of show a tin ear. And at some point, I think a lot of people just tune it out. But there's no denying that as long as we have finance laws that allow this, money is going to seek out key races, both the Senate races as well as the House races. So it's just a financially saturated environment, and most of this money is spent on, you know, big $5-7 million ad buys. I think some of it's wasted. Some of it may hit the mark, but it's just sort of a new reality. And this time around, this race, along with one or two others, is right in the center of it.
Yeah, tune it out or put it in the fireplace. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, Dean will recall, too, One Nation's the same group, going back to the Tinier comment, which is spot on, Dean. One Nation is the same group that aired the ad against Hassan, saying she was holding hostage money to fight the drug war in New Hampshire. Very bald charge, very strong charge. Ayotte condemned the ad and essentially said One Nation should take it down, and it was taken down soon after Ayotte raised that objection. Are there connections between these super PACs and the candidates? Absolutely there are. But the candidates do not control the message. And very often these super PACs go off the reservation and make it worse for the candidate.
Yeah, they complicate the situation for the
candidates.
Well,
I don't think viewers really can make that distinction. I mean,
they
can tell from the ad who's being promoted and who's being denigrated in it.
Right.
They don't read the fine print at the very end saying who paid for the ad.
Well, it's real interesting, right, Brian, and maybe we should spend some time with you just looking at all these ads and who's funding them and in terms of the impact they're having on other campaigns as well. What are the other races, Brian, where you're going to be following the money?
Well, you know, I think we'll keep an eye on this one, the House races to some point. But, you know, we've also been talking over there in the digital pod about looking at the state Senate. If you sort of take the data over the last 10 or 20 years, you can really see that spending on these state Senate races is really going up a lot. I mean, the increase has been, you know, exponential over the years. And we're going to probably take a look at a handful of those to see what accounts for that rise.
All right. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Brian Walston, NHPR's digital journalist. He's been reporting on money and politics with NHPR's election team. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange, and let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, thoughts on the New Hampshire News of the Week are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Kevin and Dean, you know, it's interesting. Brian talked about we're going to be taking some of our focus on state races. The gubernatorial candidates on the Republican side had a debate already this week, Dean, on WGIR. Hats off to GIR, a substantive event. Lots of good issues, lots of good discussion. Just remind us first, Dean, please, who these candidates are.
Well, on the Republican side, we have four candidates. Chris Sununu is a current member of the Executive Council, a member of the Sununu clan. We know the name well. Ted Gatzis, current mayor of Manchester, former state Senate president in the early 2000s, I believe, like around 2003 or 2004. Frank Edelblue is a sort of a Tea Party-style conservative first-term state rep. And Jeannie Forrester, who's been a state senator for many years and is the sort of handles the budget in the Senate. So it's a nice sized group of people, a lot of experience there. And they've been mixing it up pretty good for a while now. I think the Democrats are starting to catch up in terms of engaging each other. But certainly on the Republican side, this debate is just sort of one of a number of opportunities that they've had to kind of go at each other. And thus far, Chris Sununu seems to be the biggest target. That's often a sign that you're sort of considered the de facto front runner. Polling shows Ted Gatsis is also well known, Jeanie Forrester and Frank Edelblue much less so. So that's kind of the current dynamics of the race.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you're right, Dean, in this WGIR debate, Chris Sununu did seem to be a target.
Same in the previous debates. Yeah.
Yeah. So here we're going to hear just a little bit from that debate. And let me set it up for folks. This is the topic of the state's opioid crisis. Chris Sununu talks about it, and then Ted Gatsis jumps in on the issue of leadership. This is because earlier in the race, Chris Sununu said there's been, quote unquote, no leadership on this issue. And people like, you know, Nick Willett in Manchester and Mayor Gatsis and others said, hey, wait a minute, we've been working on this thing. So that's the context for this little dust up we're going to hear from the WGIR debate.
The issue here is, are we going to have leaders that stand up and put constituents first? Are we going to have leaders that stand up and vote for the constituents over politics? That's what this is about. And for all these for these other candidates to come up here and play political games with it, I think is just absolutely ridiculous. I've always fought for my constituents. I put my
Chris, you talk about political games, but here you are playing political games with lives of people that are dying from this crisis of opiates. So, you know, let's talk about politics. And when you want to play the political game, I can play it as well as anybody. And if you want to jump into that, I'll jump into it. This election's about leadership and experience. That's what it's all about.
Okay, is that what it's all about, Kevin Landrigan?
I think it's all about blood sport, right? I mean, this primary is as Dean said, it's gotten really aggressive. And the most surprising posture I see in this primary clearly is Chris Sununu. And I say that because Sununu, I'm not sure he's going to win this race. He's the favorite. He's got the name recognition. But Sununu not only knows he's the target, he knows it's a bad year for the franchise. I mean, he understands. Look at what happened in New Hampshire, what we've been talking about. When Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders win the presidential primary, that means big names, dynasties could be extinct in this election.
Like Jeb Bush.
Yeah, like Jeb Bush, like the Sununus, and like the Shaheens if they were on the ballot this time. So Sununu's trying to recast himself. And how does he do that? As a moderate who can appeal to independents, he says, I'm for decriminalizing marijuana. He says, I'm open to casino gambling. I mean, these aren't positions that a doctrinaire conservative Republican takes. But Sununu understands because the name has an advantage, but it has a disadvantage. So we've got to find ways to appeal to swing voters. If we can get them into this primary, that's what he's doing.
So, Dean, a couple issues that Kevin mentioned there, one being decriminalization. That came up in this debate. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing the extent to which the discussion around legalizing and or decriminalizing marijuana has become kind of a central focus of politics in the state. There's a lot of polling data in the state that shows that the majority of New Hampshireites favor decrim and legalization on the order of a Colorado or a Washington state. The House has passed decriminalization, I think, 7 or 8 times in the last 7 or 8 years, and the state Senate has blocked it. Governor Hassan has generally opposed it. We just saw the Marijuana Project endorse Frank Edelblue and Steve Marchand on the Democratic side.
Is that the first time they've done that? Neither of you know? The Marijuana Policy Project?
Yeah, I think so in a race for governor. They've occasionally endorsed candidates for state legislature.
And Jim Rubin's on the Senate primary and the Republican side they've endorsed. So it was interesting to see that that's becoming a much more accepted part of the policy discussion than it once was.
I thought that was interesting, too. And let's just hear, since you mentioned it, Dean, here's first-term Republican State Representative Frank Edelblue, a longtime businessman, talking about his support for decriminalization in the state.
We are incarcerating nonviolent people that have addiction problems that need to get solved. Throwing them in prison will not solve this problem. Decriminalization will allow our law enforcement resources to be focused on the real problems.
And often, Kevin Landrigan, when people say the real problem, they continue it by saying the opioid crisis.
Right.
How are you hearing these candidates talk about the opioid crisis?
Yeah, it's
interesting. These Republican candidates for governor.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's essentially become a proxy for leadership, and that's what And that's what you're seeing the conflict being all about. Essentially, that Sununu is saying people didn't lead early enough and allowed this crisis to get out of hand. Sununu has been critical of the budget veto by Maggie Hassan. He's been critical of Mayor Ted Gattis. How come there wasn't anything in your 2015 State of the City speech on the opioid crisis? I mean, it's kind of the luxury a guy like Sununu has, and what do I mean by that? He's got the name, he's got the money, and he's got a position on the executive council that really had very little role in solving the opioid crisis and can take very little blame for the fact New Hampshire was perhaps behind the curve. So he's taking advantage of that, and he's certainly upsetting both Jeanne Forrester and Ted Gattis in how he's characterizing it.
Well, let's talk about Jeanne Forrester a little bit. We played a clip of her at the beginning of the show, Dean, talking about fiscal matters, and she was the chair of the Senate Finance Committee for a long time. We heard her talk about expanded gambling, saying, "I would not support it." Here we are. What is it, 2016? We're still talking about expanded gambling. What's your sense of these Republicans and how they approach this?
We probably will still be talking about it 5 years from now. You know, as we mentioned, Chris Sununu said he was open to gambling. The others were not. I mean, Jeanne Forrester is an interesting case. I had a chance to interview her a little while back, and she really is positioning herself kind of as sort of a small town kind of conservative Republican. She's a little more socially conservative than the others. She has all this experience with budgetary matters in the state Senate. So she's just trying to kind of separate herself a little bit from the others as not necessarily a Tea Party style conservative, but a more traditional conservative than maybe the other candidates. So that's kind of been her particular niche. And she's been very active. You look at the polling data, she and Frank Edelblut are still largely unknown, which I think is a problem for them, given that Sununu and Gattis are much better known. But she's been campaigning pretty actively.
One more question for you guys on this Republican gubernatorial race. And again, it's a real interesting debate. A lot of meat there for those who say it's all, you know, all style and no substance. Ted Gattis, I heard him a lot during this debate, Kevin Landrigan, talk about his business experience. I've been covering politics in New Hampshire for a long time. When I think of Ted Gattis, I think state senator and mayor of Manchester. I don't think businessman.
Yeah, that's what people forget about Teddy Gattis. I mean, that's really when he started getting involved in politics, when he was a businessman. He and his brother started what was called the Staffing Network, which basically—
Got pretty big, didn't it?
Got huge, yeah. It was 5,000 employees, sold to ADP. He and his brother supposedly pulled over $40 million in cash out of the sale, did very well. But he was a very aggressive businessman and got interested in politics during that whole business experience. So he's trying to make that work for him in this race.
All right. Coming up, more Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us your thoughts, questions, comments about some of the top Granite State headlines that we're covering this week. Our guests are Kevin Landrigan, senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital. And with us now is Paige Sutherland, NHPR's Statehouse reporter. She's done a lot of NHPR's reporting on the opioid crisis. And Paige, thank you very much for taking time out.
Yeah, thanks for letting me be here.
Well, you reported this week, Paige, on a new drug treatment facility opening up in the city of Franklin called Farnham North. What does this new center, Paige, add to the state's treatment capacity? Because we often hear it's quite limited.
Yeah, so the center has been up and running. Basically, they expanded it. So they had 21 beds, and now they have 42, thus tripling their capacity. And this center, the problem was, is they had a waiting list of 40 people on average every day. And so these 42 new beds means that they don't have to turn away parents who are crying and want their kids to get the help. Because as we all know, if addiction, when you ask for that help, there isn't a 28, oh, you can come back in 28 days and maybe we'll have a bed for you. So So everyone at the center was just in awe that we have 42 new beds in Franklin, a hard-hit area for this opioid crisis. And the biggest thing about this project was that it was all hands on deck. The community stepped up. We had donations that were put to make these beds available, as well as the local Rotary Club used their hands and built the closet doors that got the facility to be licensed. So it was this kind of this community getting together that really got these beds opened up.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that, Paige, and ask Kevin and Dean as well. So you're right. It was a big deal. Governor Hassan was there. There was a ribbon cutting. I mean, you know, sort of lots of balloons and confetti and three cheers for us. What do you make of that? I mean, this is a drug treatment facility. Not that long ago, people might have said, I don't want one of these in my corner.
Yeah, no, I mean, this has been front and center for the past year now. As we know, me and Kevin at the State House, I mean, so many bills were passed last legislative session. The governor has been at every stumps up she's been at. She's always addressed this as, you know, this is what I've done. This is my focus. And the biggest thing that the governor also has been very urgent about was breaking down the stigma. And so, you know, as you saw at the ribbon cutting, it's, you know, addiction is a public health problem. And that's what the state is trying to address it as.
Kevin, what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, it's I think as Paige knows, I think one of the reasons why this is a big story is because this is a crying need, meaning New Hampshire just has really fallen behind in terms of capacity to deal with these folks. And Governor Hassan's been speaking about it for a couple of years now, even before her reelection bid. And it's a real striking contrast to, say, 20, 25 years ago. We had 15 different treatment programs all around the state. There were an assortment of federal and foundation grant programs that were available and were supporting these organizations. Many of those have fallen by the wayside now, and that's why we saw law enforcement people, treatment people go to Washington and try and plead for more money. And why we're having this discussion about making Medicaid expansion permanent. Why is that? The reason is these addicts, these folks who need treatment beds, fall right into that sweet spot that's dealt with the Medicaid expansion. And the sweet spot is very low income and very single, meaning once they may not have been single. They may have been married and had kids, but addiction broke up the family. The kids and the wife have gone elsewhere. This person no longer can keep a job, has very, very low income, but not low enough to qualify for traditional Medicaid. Hassan essentially says you got to make Medicaid expansion permanent because then the treatment providers know that's a population we're always going to have.
What do you think about this, Dean? The broad political support that we've seen for the opening of these treatment facilities. I mean, in Paige's story about Farnham North, there's a picture of Governor Hassan right next to the mayor of Franklin, a Republican and Democrat, and everybody's smiling and, you know, cutting a big, beautiful ribbon.
Yeah, well, it's clear that New Hampshire is trying to make up a deficit that it has in this area, and they're making progress. But, you know, we just did a story on the Roundup a few weeks ago about how, you know, opioid deaths now with fentanyl mixed in increasingly will likely outpace last year. So, you know, in the end, the proof is going to be whether or not these numbers come down. But, you know, I think there's general agreement among both parties that this is about leadership, as we discussed, that something needs to be done. But, you know, there are debates about, you know, who pays for it, where the resources go. There are philosophical debates about how to balance the kind of recovery culture with the law and order culture. I think there's more agreement on that than there once was, but that's still an underlying dimension as well. So we're just going to have to wait and see. It may take a few years of this for things to turn around. But there's no question that in every major statewide political race, it's a key way of talking about the broader issue of leadership.
Paige, you want to jump in on that too, please?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to jump on Kevin's comments a little bit, going back to Farnham North. And, you know, a lot of this population are people who don't have private insurance, who are low income. And with this center, through donations, they're going to be able to allow people, you know, allow patients who don't have insurance, they're going to be able to double their donation so that they can give financial aid to these people, because that's a big hurdle. I mean, these rehabs, even if you have enough beds, a lot of them can't afford it. It's an expensive financial burden. And so this center, 42 beds, you can sign up and you don't need insurance. And there's a lot of financial aid. They're going to have about over $2 million this year that they're going to offer patients.
One last question for you, Paige, please. What other treatment expansion projects are in the works or at least being discussed at this point?
Yeah, I mean, definitely there's a lot in the works. A lot of these Farnham North type expansions, a lot of, you know, facilities that are already up and running or trying to expand their treatment capacity. And also there's, you know, some talks of taking the Laconia State School, which is abandoned and hasn't been used since 09, and turning that into a rehab
facility.
That's
a big building.
That's a big building. And I mean, again, because of that, there's a lot of questions. The community wants to get involved. You know, who's going to pay for it? Who's going to rehab it? Obviously, an old building. It's, you know, there's going to be a lot of damages that are going to need to be paid for and fixed up. And then there's also this project that's been in the works for a year now, the former Hoyt Furniture Building over in Manchester. I mean, that's going to be opening very shortly. And that's supposed to be this one-stop treatment center in Manchester, which has been the heart of this problem. And so they're going to have counseling, hopefully treatment facilities. Hopefully they're even talking about offering affordable housing right there for people. So that's going to be a big project once that opens.
All right. Lots to talk about. Paige, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Paige Sutherland. And again, she's NHPR State House reporter, done a lot of reporting here at NHPR on the opioid crisis. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. You can join us with your questions, comments, thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kevin Landrigan, I'm hoping you can help me figure out a story this week that has a lot of moving parts. You ready?
Okay.
The New Hampshire court system seemed to be at odds with the state attorney general, Joe Foster, over the issue of guns, background checks, mental illness. Can you just help us figure this out?
Yeah. Some weeks ago, the attorney general certainly surprised conservative Republicans in the legislature by essentially saying, look, there's this new law that the legislature's passed, and it's going to require that people it's going to require us to report people who have serious mental illness to the federal criminal background check system. New Hampshire's one of a minority of states that doesn't automatically do that and hasn't ever automatically done that, and attempts to emphatically do that through separate pieces of legislation have always died. This really upset conservative legislators, particularly gun supporters, these folks with mental illness issues would be on the background check system because, in their view, one, if a mistake is made, they contend it's almost impossible to get off the background check system if that initial mistake was made. The other is obviously people mental illness is not a static phenomenon. People have problems with mental illness and then recover from problems with mental illness. And those folks would be unable to obtain a gun because they were reported to the criminal background check system as having this flag.
So I'm guessing.
But like this is a man bites dog story. And by that, I mean you never see the court system essentially say to the attorney general, hey, by the way, you read the law wrong.
Well,
and we disagree
with you.
That's
what I was going to ask you.
That's why this has become this really startling story. And now the court clerk has said, well, if the attorney general wants to come and ask for a clarification, meaning ask for the Supreme Court's permission to see the law as I see the law, he can do that, but he's not going to get anywhere.
So this is really that's what struck me. I mean,
yes.
Besides the issue itself,
right,
which is interesting that New Hampshire is one of just a few states that doesn't report people with mental illness to the background check system.
Right.
This idea that they're both part of the judicial branch, right? I mean,
they are. And as I say, you rarely see the court system read a law differently than the state's chief prosecutor. I will say the conservative Republicans basically, again, this is politics. This is an election year, and they smell politics here. And by that, I mean this. They feel the attorney general was essentially doing the governor's bidding. The governor running for the U.S. Senate is talking about criminal background checks, right, and about how weak Kelly Ayotte is in terms of closing loopholes for criminal background checks. So they feel that the attorney general has made this interpretation in order to increase the debate over the background check
system. I see. Helping
I don't prescribe
Governor
to
Hansen.
That, but that's certainly what conservative Republicans are saying.
One more story I did want to ask both of you about. Dean, I'll turn to you first. A story we have talked about almost every week on the Roundup, and that's the Northern Pass and all these groups and towns and individual property owners who want to chime in on the process by the Site Evaluation Committee. This week, the city of Concord said, we don't want to be grouped with surrounding towns like Deerfield. We want to be on our own when it comes to evaluating this project and its impact on us. How come?
Yeah, well, I think it's an opportunity to plead its case more directly and talk about issues that are specific to Concord. You know, the larger issue here is public input on the state site evaluation committee. This committee was revamped in the last year or so. And the idea was to have sort of greater public input. So Concord is arguing that that this idea of grouping towns together, and we're Concord here, we're in with, I think, Pembroke and one or two other cities as well, Deerfield, as you mentioned, towns. So they're arguing that, well, this makes participation harder because we can't really effectively plead our case before the site evaluation committee, which is currently considering the Northern Pass project. So go to the state Supreme Court, and this will have ramifications for other cities and towns as well, depending on what the court says. But basically, their argument is, you know, you revamp the process to have more public input, and this idea of lumping cities together goes against that idea of greater input.
Well, something to follow up on for another day, because it is really interesting. The site evaluation committee said, look, we have so many people who want to jump in. We have to group you. But then the people in the group said, no, I don't really like the people I'm in a
different
group with.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I always love to close out the roundup by asking you guys what you're going to be covering next week. So, Dean, how about you? What are you going to be working on?
Be looking at the ripple effect of the two conventions. I think I've watched enough television for the next month, so I'm going to try to stay away from TV and see what happens.
You should listen to the radio, Dean.
Yeah, do that as well occasionally. And then by next Friday, we're only 5 weeks out from the state primaries, and there's some big state primaries coming up on September 13th.
That's right, and we heard earlier about that robust primary for governor on both sides. How about you, Kevin? What are you working on?
And that's what we'll be working on Wednesday. There'll be the first big debate between the Democratic candidates for governor on GIR. As Dean pointed out in the program, Colin Van Ostrom, Mark Connolly, Steve Marchand, they're starting to mix it up a bit. We expect this one to be lively, the first kind of lively exchange between them. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. This is The Exchange on NHPR.